From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Edward Curtis's photographs of Native Americans in the early 1900s fill history textbooks and art collections. The intrepid photographer, outdoorsman, mountaineer, ethnographer produced 20 volumes with more than 2,000 photographs over 30 years. As the last of a traditional American Indian way of life was vanishing, he took his big old camera into mountains and plains, pueblo and Arctic villages, obsessed with making a record of once proud peoples and cultures before they slipped into modernity. His story is remarkable and now told again. This hour On Point, the story of Edward Curtis's vast quest to capture a vanishing Native America. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine the time when the last teepee camps were coming down, the last old ways going away? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Seattle, Washington, is Timothy Egan, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, online opinion columnist for the New York Times. His 2006, The Worst Hard Time, about Depression-era survivors in the Dust Bowl, won the National Book Award. His new book is Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, the epic life and immortal photographs of Edward Curtis. Timothy Egan, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Take us back to this moment in Native American history. You describe it, and Edward Curtis surely saw it, as a kind of hinge moment when big changes were happening, when something, a lot of somethings, were vanishing. What was this moment for Native Americans, Timothy?
Well, it's not just Curtis who saw it at a hinge moment. This is the dawn of the 20th century, 1900, and America is a nation of 75 million people. Our roads are now clogged with sputtering little automobiles. Trains link all the cities. The tribes have been moved to the margins of this huge continent, and the census has just come back and discovered that there are only 235,000, less than a quarter million Native people living in this country. The estimate, of course, was there were 20 to 40 million at the time of white contact. So the conventional wisdom, the prevailing view of scholars and government officials, is that within perhaps a generation's time, most of the original inhabitants of the continent would be gone.
Tim, can we just go back to that number for a minute? Did you say there were originally 20 to 40 million Native Americans on the continent, and at this point there were 235,000?
Right. So they've been diminished by perhaps 90% or more. And most of that was not from the Indian Wars, which were largely, you know, minor skirmishes along the way with a couple of exceptions. It was because of they had lacked immunity to the diseases of Westerners.
That's much more than 90%. But in any case, there they were, and in what kind of circumstances? Were they moving into towns? The frontier had been officially declared closed, you remind
right.
us here.
They were really literally out of sight. I mean, they're living at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, which is where Edward Curtis found the Havasupai people, a little band of folks. They're living at the top of these mesas in New Mexico, which is where he found the town of Acoma, which is been around for 1,000 years, continuously inhabited. They're at the far western shore where we found the macaw living in this savage, raw rainforest where the surf comes crashing in. And they're living in little hamlets across the plains and prairies. They've been pushed to the side. They are down to a small diminishment of their people. And just one point, Seattle, this fast-growing city where Curtis lives, the biggest city in the world, by the way, named for a Native American, has passed an ordinance making it illegal for an Indian to live within the city limits.
There's only one who remains. And you describe how she was well known. He sought her out. He brought her to his little studio. He photographed her. Who was that?
Well, they called her Princess Angeline, and she was anywhere from 80 to 95 years old. No one knew her age exactly, but she was the last surviving daughter of Chief Seattle. And they let her stay in the city, even though they'd passed this law making it illegal for Indians to live there, because she was sort of a pet, was one of the descriptions they called it. You know, they would take tourists and point her out and say, look, there's an Indian. There's
a real Indian. In a shack on the tidal flats, I think you describe her living.
Exactly. This little tiny figure stumped over with wrapped in shawls, living in a shack on Puget Sound, digging clams and selling them door to door to the, you know, fabulous new residents of this city of Seattle, also taking in people's laundry.
He brings her into his studio. Who was the man who brought her in? Who was Edward Curtis?
Well, Curtis was a homesteader's kid. His dad is a preacher, and they come out
of Wisconsin, all the way to the West Coast.
Correct. And he was a sickly man, a Civil War veteran, never healthy. And they'd no sooner picked up their homestead in Puget Sound and built their own shack that he dies.
The
and
father.
Curtis is left, right. Sure. Curtis is left raising his widowed mother and the other children. Curtis himself is a berry picker, a clam digger like Princess Angeline. But very quickly, Tom, within just a few years' time, he goes across to Seattle, mortgages the homestead, and gets involved with the portrait photography business. And within a few years' time, by the mid-1890s, he's hailed as the premier portrait photographer of this fast-growing city.
Which was quite something then. Photography was still relatively new. Photographers were sort of minor celebrities with their high-tech, big old, not high-tech now, clunky cameras.
Exactly. And people would pay a lot of money to have their portraits taken by Edward Curtis. It was a really big deal to have his little signature at the end. So people would actually come from out of town and get to wait months to get on his appointment calendar. So he could have gone on. Eventually, of course, he even shoots the pictures of Teddy Roosevelt's daughter, Alice, who was sort of the first Paris Hilton-like celebrity of the new century. So he's very prominent, rising, good-looking, charismatic, prospering portrait photographer who I call the Annie Leibovitz of his day.
I mean, he's a fabulous-looking guy. He's so very romantic. He's got his beard and his sort of high country hat on, and he just looks like a celebrity himself.
Yeah, I say he's a cross, between Indiana Jones and George Catlin. He wears his Abercrombie & Fitch. He always wears hat at an angle. He had this dashing Van Dyke beard. He was 6'2". Both men and women were attracted to him. If you read some of the profiles, people talk about his dreamy eyes and when he opened his mouth, how he could just be captivating. So he had a charm that belied his sixth grade education. He had made it no further than sixth grade in a one-room schoolhouse.
He was a big outdoorsman even before he went on his epic, endless journey to capture these images of Native America. I mean, he was a mountain guy and all over.
One of many things not very well known about Edward Curtis was he was a pioneer alpinist. He led the first party to take a significant amount of women to the top of Mount Rainier. Rainier was sort of a gentleman's Mount Everest then, and it was considered a very big deal in pre-Edwardian America to lead these gentlemen or these women, who, by the way, were forced to wear bloomers when they climbed up to the top of Mount Rainier. So again, one of Curtis's many lives, one of his many talents, I guess, was that he was this superb alpinist who had set a record and was heralded. The first time you find a notice of Edward Curtis in the national press is when he leads 100-some people to the top of Mount Rainier and later rescues the members of that party.
He's on Mount Rainier when he meets a couple of guys who will catapult him into very high society and fire up this dream of photographing the vanishing Native Americans. Who were they? What happened there?
Curtis had extraordinary luck, serendipitous luck. So he's up on Mount Rainier. He's going around with his 14 by 17 inch glass plate camera, which involves these clunky glass plate negatives that he would use. And he's shooting the shadows of this big volcano. And out of the fog, he hears a cry for help. And he comes upon two men and their acolytes. One of them is George Bird Grinnell, one of the most prominent Americans. And he was up on Rainier scouting it out for a possible national park. Curtis impresses Grinnell and Hart Merriman, the other individual, and they soon take him into his circle. These are prominent Easterners, very wealthy men, very well known, part of Teddy Roosevelt's circle, and they take him into his circle. And that starts Curtis's connection to the larger establishment.
Yeah, this is the founder of the Audubon Society, Grinnell, and right. Along with what it was, Clint Merriman was co-founder of the National Geographic Society. So these were big deals. And how do they end up firing up this incredible sense of mission, not to say obsession, to photograph all that remains of traditional Native America?
Well, it starts out as sort of a, subject and commodity thing. Curtis realizes that pictures of Indians are worth money because they're disappearing. So he pays them to sit for him. And his pictures are stunning. People see in these faces faces things they've never seen. When Curtis first shows pictures of Indians in San Francisco, his gallery show is mobbed because they're not the cardboard Indians. They're not the stereotypes one way or the other, the noble savage or the doomed people. They have multi-dimensions. They have humanity. They have something in the eyes, something in the faces. He always was so good at getting multiple dimensions. But initially, he sees this thing as a commodity exchange. I mean, there's no other way to put it. He thinks he can make money off it. But in the summer of 1900, he has an epiphany when he goes to Montana with Bird Grinnell, who had been going to the Plains Indians' homeland for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And the Indians, in fact, had given him his name Bird. And that's what changes Curtis. That's what launches him on what would be the largest photographic odyssey in American history.
Before it's all over, Teddy Roosevelt is very interested in this. J.P. Morgan, the huge financier, is the money behind it. And Timothy, your guy goes more or less to the ends of the earth on this continent to bring it to life, not just with a camera, big old camera of that day, but recording on wax cylinder, 10,000 recordings of Native American music and more behind us right here. One of those recordings from Edward Curtis way back. Timothy Eakin is with us. His new book is Short Night of the Shadow Catcher, the epic life and immortal photographs of Edward Curtis. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with the great Western photographer who captured the last great images of vanishing Native America, Hopi, Sioux, Apache, Comanche, and more, mountain man, adventurer, Indiana Jones with a camera, Edward Curtis. Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter Timothy Eakin writes of his story in his new book, Short Night of the Shadow Catcher. Behind us right here, you can hear he also recorded on wax cylinder Native American ceremony and more all over. This is British Columbia, 1910, the song Wild Man of the Woods, sung by Native Americans accompanying a dancer, a wild man, who was said to embody the spirit of the forest, moving slowly over the ground. There's a great gallery of just a tiny fraction of the photographs of Edward Curtis at our website. You should really check them out. Tim Eakin, before he had the trek into J.P. Morgan's office, how did he begin to capture these images of Native Americans over such a wide expanse? Give us some of his travels, his treks.
Right. Well, he decides in 1900 that he will try to photograph all intact Native American communities in North America.
Intact, quote unquote. I mean, whatever that meant right. by that point.
I mean, imagine 100 people trying to do this. Imagine you or I going to Europe and starting in Liechtenstein and working our way through the European countries, their cultures, their creation myths, their languages, their people, their villages. And it just becomes this huge obsession. 80 tribes is what it turns out to be. So he crosses the country more than 100 times by train, by horseback, by wagon. America is becoming quite modern, but where Curtis is going is not modern, except for the missionaries who sometimes get there a few years ahead of him, and he really hates that. But he has to go to these incredibly hard-to-reach places. And initially, they're somewhat reluctant to have this man in their midst. They throw dirt at his camera. They kick him. They lure him with women so they can report him later to the Indian agents. Here's one of the many ironies at the start of the century. We love the First Amendment. It respects anyone's right to worship the God of their choice, unless you're Native American. And so the Religious Crimes Code makes it a felony for these people to practice many of their rituals. So what Curtis is trying to capture is not just what's seemingly disappearing, but what is illegal as well. The snake dance, the sun dance, the potlatch in the Northwest Indians, all these rituals and ceremonies that they've been doing for centuries have now been made crimes.
They were literally illegal for the Native Americans, the American Indians, to perform these religious dances, ceremonies?
Yeah, I said it's akin to British authorities going into Ireland in the 19th century and outlawing high Roman Catholic Mass, because people have been the Sundance is the central religious ceremony of the Blackfeet, for example. And so, yes, it's illegal. He's essentially accomplice to a crime.
And presumably, he had to win a lot of confidence from the Native Americans to make them open to him, photographing them at all, let alone these outlawed ceremonies.
Well, he benefited from having a lot of natives on his payroll, and he would work years and years and years. In some cases of the Hopi, he worked more than 10 years over 5 long visits to win their confidence to get into their society, to be able to take these very intimate pictures. But he always would send tribal translators out ahead of time, sometimes years ahead, to start laying the groundwork. So he learned sort of by, you know, hit and miss how to win the confidence of the tribes. Now, near the end of his odyssey, they're asking for him. It's sort of that he gets these letters saying, will you come shoot the pictures of the Arikara? Will you come down to the Southwest and do us? Because people realize that his goal, which, as he said, was, I want to make them live forever. Mm. I want to make them live forever, that they want to be immortalized as well. Now, the recordings that you played, which I love, they're just so beautiful and haunting, turn out to be just invaluable because these languages do nearly slip away. These songs do nearly slip away. And there's nothing like hearing it, like we just heard it now, which gave me chills, by the way. Nothing like hearing it to understand what, you know, the nuances are, where the beat is, etc.
What was it about Edward Curtis's treatment photographically of these subjects, American Indians, that set his work apart from a lot of other depiction of Indians? I mean, George Catlin had been all over the West. There were plenty of sort of dime store, cigar store Indian images, which were almost morbidly popular souvenirs among Americans at that time. What made his photographs different?
They were. That's a good point, Tom. They were sold as postcards. Catlin somewhat romanticized the tribes, and his stuff was somewhat inaccurate, particularly in the northern tribes. The dime store Indians were about 10 years away from the Hollywood Indians, which would be basically Italian guys in face paint. And so there were these very stereotypical images done of the original inhabitants. Curtis, starting with the picture he took of little Princess Angeline, tried to see something that defied what the common assessment was at the time. He tried to see their humanity, the face of someone that wasn't necessarily a tribe, a race, but an individual human being. And you know, you do see sort of a lost look in some of the faces, but you also see, particularly like in the picture of Geronimo, in which he poses Geronimo in a single U.S. Army blanket, why did he do that? Because Geronimo was the last of the so-called violently resistant Native Americans. He gave up in the late 19th century. What did the Army give him when he surrendered with his 6 fellow Apache? Mm. They gave him an Army blanket.
That's
so
it.
So Curtis poses him in an Army blanket, and the face, the resulting image is Geronimo looking just utterly defiant, and it is one of these universal pictures that he got.
You say that anthropologists at that time tended to they divided into schools who either saw Native Americans as the noble savage or racial determinists who saw Darwinian roadkill in the collapse of the tribes. And he clearly doesn't fit neatly in either of those categories.
No, and the evidence of the Darwinian roadkill was that they were disappearing. And a lot of people said it was the hand of providence, that God himself was wiping out these people to make way for a superior race of people that were replacing them. Why else would they be dying so much? Curtis goes along the wild, undammed Columbia River, where Lewis and Clark had seen these extraordinary intact communities every 10 miles along the river. And all Curtis sees are graveyards. A handful of people fishing here and there, but mostly they're gone. So the view is that they're being wiped out for this other wave of people to move in.
We've got images of people doing all kinds of things here, net making and cooking, a field full of teepees and what looks like quite a traditional, a temporary village there. This fishing along the river with a very long spear, looks maybe 20-foot long spear, and the Native American on the rock above that rushing river. Among the chieftains that he met, one of the fiercest was not Native American at all, but J.P. Morgan. How did J.P. Morgan come into the story, and what was that meeting like?
That's a great story. Morgan is the richest banker in the United States. He's essentially the Federal Reserve before we had a Federal Reserve. He's the guy that would fix monetary policy when we'd have one of these periodic panics. He's also no friend of Indians. His railroads, which he helped to consolidate through his trusts, probably did more to speed the collapse of Indian communities than anything else. The tribes themselves, the folks said, once they saw the iron horses of the railroads coming across the plains, they knew they were doomed because people would shoot buffalo from the windows. These trains would go into Indian territories, etc. So Morgan's no friend of Native Americans, but he does like beautiful things. He's nearly 70 years old, and he's a collector of Renaissance art and young mistresses. And Edward Curtis, desperate for money because this project is consuming him. He has as many as 30 people on his staff at one time, but is always broke. His portrait business is not paying for it. Finds his way into Morgan's lair, sits down and looks at the mighty stare of J.P. Morgan. Morgan gives him about 2 minutes and then says, "Mr. Curtis, there are many demands on my time. I have to go now. I'm sorry, I can't help you." Now, most people would have folded their tent and gone out the door. Curtis did not. That was one of his character traits. The guy had great courage, and he stood put, and he opens up his folio, and he shows Morgan one more picture. It's an 11-year-old Mojave girl. Her name is Mosa. And it's this, again, a hauntingly beautiful Curtis photograph. She's got just a couple of streaks of paint down her cheeks. Her hair is somewhat unkempt. But again, it's the eyes. And Morgan looks at the picture of Mosa, and it moves him. He finds it's beautiful. He shakes Curtis's hand. He agrees to fund him for $75,000, which is a lot of money. And he says to him as he goes, he says, "I like a man who attempts the impossible."
Yes, and that's what it turned out to be. And the Morgan family ending up putting $2 million some dollars into this. None of it made Edward Curtis rich. He never paid himself, only for his expenses to get this done. And he died in the 1950s. Penniless. These photographs are just amazing. Tim, we've got people calling in for you. Harold's calling from Quincy, Massachusetts. Harold, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, this is a great show today. I'm interested in the subject because I've been a collector of antiquarian prints for a number of years. And predecessor to the photography era, there are some marvelous images by the Carl Bodmer, the McKinney Hall Portrait Gallery, and George Catlin. These are artists and explorers that went out to the Indian tribes before they were totally decimated and forced into the reservation.
Mm-hmm.
They're marvelous interpretations, and of course, I've seen the Curtis folio, and once again, the elegance of these regal Native Americans are so marvelous to see in photographs. But the vanishing race was vanishing because of the white European and American colonialists that performed genocide on them and took their land and their animals away. That's why you have what's happening today. But the legacy of the images stand in my heart forever. And don't forget the predecessors, their magnificent images of engravings, lithographs, and various others during the times when they still had viability in this country, which was their country.
Harold, I so appreciate your call and the passion you bring to describing those. One more, if I may. Thank you. Nancy in Newton, Massachusetts. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm so glad you're treating this subject. I just want to say that sometime between 1925 and 1928, my parents-in-law took a trip from Berlin to the United States to see the Grand Canyon and the West. And my mother-in-law found Native American faces and the countryside deeply beautiful. And she probably bought 15 photos by Mr. Curtis, which I have.
Wow.
And they're portraits, beautiful portraits. They're groups of Native Americans, sometimes on horseback in the desert, sometimes in the mountains. She loved their faces. She found that they had such dignity and such bearing and seemed so wise that that's why I'm calling.
And those portraits are still with you today. Tim Egan, how common is that? How widely were these reproduced?
Yeah, I wanted to discuss that for one second. Mm-hmm. Remember, the masterpiece that is Edward Curtis's work was 20 volumes of these sets. The individual sets, there are less than 300 of them in existence. So over 30 years, he does these 20 volume sets. It was very difficult to produce a photograph the way he did it. He would take these 14x17 glass plates and then project them onto metal in some cases and then engrave them later. They were called photogravures. He also did prints on paper that was made of egg white. Those are called album prints. Mm-hmm. He also did these gold prints finished in gold. So the process itself was very complicated. And a comment on the earlier suggestion by the gentleman about genocide. Curtis started out somewhat dispassionate. He wasn't an advocate. He was just this artist who realized he was onto something and he had great energy and great love for the faces. As time goes on in the 30-year epic, he becomes an advocate. He's actually instrumental in Native Americans becoming citizens with the passage of the Indian Citizenship Act in 1934. He's outraged near the end of his epic. By the time he gets to California, he just can't contain himself. He says people have taken pot shots at Indians. Our record of what we've done is just, you know, it doesn't stand up to any sort of scrutiny. He's starting to see the world from the point of view of his subjects.
And with that, does his work change, or is it the same commitment, the same eye?
No, the work does change. And so by the time he gets to Oklahoma, which was, as most of your listeners know, the designated Indian territory for a long time, mm-hmm. It's where they put the tribes from the east. It's where they basically dumped Native Americans and moved them, in the Cherokee's case, of the Trail of Tears. And he goes down there to see the Comanche. And he thinks, you know, the Comanche were the Lord of the Plains. They were the most feared tribe. They ruled Texas and most of the Southwest, and other tribes feared them. The whites feared them. The Texas Rangers feared them. They were this proud, large group of 12 bands. He goes down there and he sees nothing on this tiny little reservation but a handful of people. So he shoots pictures of people in ties and dress shirts and short hair. I mean, people think that Curtis always romanticized his subjects or put them. If they had what they wore in their traditional outfits, he would certainly ask them to wear that. But in the case of the Comanche, he sees a people who are Christianized and modern looking, and that's what he shoots. One more discussion, mm-hmm. real quick on the process and on the rarity of this. So remember, there are less than 300 of the complete sets. One just sold at auction 3 weeks ago at New York at Swan's Gallery for $1.4 million. Curtis dies broke and penniless, having lost his copyright to J.P. Morgan. Morgan later sells it to a Boston book dealer for $1,000, and that dealer dies, and the pictures and the masterpiece and the treasury sits in a basement in Boston for 20 years.
That we'll look more at that story. And what about the rarity or otherwise of the kind of individual prints that apparently Nancy's mother-in-law, visiting from Germany, found in the 1920s at the Grand Canyon?
I would tell Nancy's mother-in-law to certainly hold on to those prints and don't let your kids sell them in a garage sale or an auction. Individual Curtis prints have sold for as much as $250,000, depending on how the finishing process is done. People have cannibalized the sets, pulled them apart to sell them. They do sort of float around all over the place because he produced so many images.
Talking with Timothy Egan. His new book is Short Night of the Shadow Catcher, The Epic Life and Immortal Photographs of Edward Curtis. You can read an excerpt at our website and see a wonderful gallery of images as well there. Here's the prelude to Edward Curtis's 1914 silent film, Headhunters. We'll talk about that as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Behind me, Bear Song, Winter Dance, Edward Curtis, recorded in 1910, Fort Rupert, British Columbia, a song that would have accompanied a dancer in full-body bearskin. on Wax Cylinder, 1910. My guest today is Timothy Egan, joins us from Seattle, Washington, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and author of the new book Short Night of the Shadow Catcher, The Epic Life and Immortal Photographs of Edward Curtis. It was not only wax cylinders, but tens of thousands of photographic images of the last of traditional culture in many corners of North America, photographed by Edward Curtis. Roger in Toronto, Canada. Thanks for calling, Roger. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Mr. Egan, and thanks for your column. Mm-hmm. I am familiar with Curtis's photographs, but I had no idea that he made recordings. 10,000 wax cylinders. I'd like to know where they are and what's being done with them. Is there any project to digitize them, for example?
Tim, it is amazing. How did he do it? How do they hold up? Where are they now?
That's a great question. I've been asked that quite a bit since I've been talking about this subject across the U.S. He learned how to use this wax cylinder from E.H. Harriman, one of the last of the wealthy gentleman explorers. And Curtis had gone with him to Alaska in 1899, and they had taken this along. Thereafter, Curtis never went anywhere without his wax cylinder recorder. He also had with him a primitive motion picture camera. He was an early techie. And in fact, the film that Curtis made in the teens, the 19-teens, was a pioneering all-Indian cast narrative documentary. Now, the recordings are incredibly valuable, as I said, because tribes that have, in some cases, they were down to the last individual who spoke or sang the language. And then when they went years later to revive the language, here was the authentic. Here was the original. As with most things in the Curtis treasure, they've been disseminated to the wind. After Curtis lost his copyright, after Morgan sold them, they've scattered across the country. The images are all most of the images are digitized and are public domain, owned by all of us, and you can see them in the Library of Congress, see them online. The recordings are in different places. Some universities have them, some don't. They're not gathered in one place, but because Curtis took a complete photographic and audio picture of American Indian life over 30 years, the thing should be preserved in its entirety, and it never has been.
But that it would be, will be, just fantastic to hear those recordings. Just really,
it really is. And it's. I mean, I say to people, imagine trying to read the entire Beatles catalog just based on sheet music. It's one thing to see it, but it's another thing to hear it.
It really is. John in Sterling, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I am one of the folks that Curtis things got spread out into the wind. I was involved with a group of people who found the copper plates that produced the images that went into the North American Indian 20-volume set.
Where did you find them? Where, John? When?
Tell us more.
They were in Laureate's bookstore.
Sure.
In Boston.
Yes, know it well. Yes.
Actually, yeah. Charles Laureate was actually on the board of directors of Curtis's company titled North American Indian Incorporated. Mm-hmm. And he ended up with the copper plates in Boston.
I think if Tim records correctly, you or your group bought all these plates for $1,000. Is that correct?
No, that's what Larry paid the Morgan company for the right to sell them. He paid $1,000.
I see.
And I think if I'm correct on this, Laureate survived the sinking of the Lusitania, but he didn't live much longer after he picked up the Curtis Trove. I think he died in the 1930s.
So was the value of these understood by the time you and your group came to acquire them, John?
No. We ended up purchasing one of the complete sets that Tim was talking about from Sotheby's, I believe, in New York. I think we paid $30,000 for it.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
And you just made the comment that one was sold for $1.2 million. Was that what
million
you said?
$1.4 million. And it wasn't a very good set. It was somewhat dirty. It needed to be cleaned.
Uh-huh.
Wow. And what drew you to these, John? Did you understand these as important historical artifacts? Was it a romantic attraction? What?
Well, it was. I am looking at the first picture, Curtis picture that I have, I saw, and it absolutely blew me away. It is so moving.
Do you remember which one it is?
I'm looking at it, Tom.
Oh, what is it? Tell us.
Yeah, come on.
Okay, it is called Offering to the Sun, San Ildefonso. Mm-hmm. And it is of a Native American Indian with, it's a sunrise picture, with two feathers in his hand lifted up, a brilliant sky, and two rocks, one in back of him that is, you know, the takes the full left side of the picture, and one in front of him that takes about half of it. And this sun that he's sort of half facing with his hands up. It's just extraordinary.
Wow.
And it just, you know.
John, we're glad you got hold of these, and we hope you've taken good care of them.
I am doing my best.
And okay. John, don't sell them to send your kids to college is what I would advise.
Hang on if you can. John, thank you so much for that story. It really brings it home. Timothy, Tim, describe a few more of these. I mean, just the one on the cover of your book, for example. And it looks like it must be Edward Curtis, the photographer himself, and he's out staring with a half dozen marvelous-looking men up into a mountain range. Where is that? What is that?
Right. We found that picture in the Curtis Archives from the Library of Congress, but it's undated and untitled. I'm pretty sure it's in Arizona. With the Navajo, he spent the majority of his time in the Southwest. He loved the Hopi Nation. He loved the Navajo Nation. He was entranced by not just the native people living pretty intact lives, but the land itself. He was from the wet Pacific Northwest, and he would go down to the dry Southwest, and he would describe it as the earth turned inside out. So that's where they're pointing to him and showing some. They're pointing to him, showing where the gods are, some of their worship sites, etc. Curtis never went, quote, full Indian. It wasn't like Dancing with Wolves, the movie, or something like that. They had a derisive term for that. They would call it going to the blanket. He always was a photographer. He never put on. But he did want to get inside. So he spent almost 10 years until the Hopi let him into the Snake Dance Society. He was allowed to handle the rattlers, and they had to sleep for 10 days in this giant pit with the rattlesnakes before you'd come out and do the actual ceremony. I mean, it was a kind of immersion that a handful of filmmakers and artists do now, but Curtis had pioneered it, as with so many other things.
What about the way that the Native Americans are presented? You know, in this photograph and others, there's sometimes pure traditional, what looks to an untutored eye, like pure traditional costume or clothing. In this photograph on the book cover, some of them are wearing partly westernized clothes, you know,
yes.
Shirt and vest, white shirt, and well, but along with a lot of what looks like ceremonial dress, not even everyday Native American dress, but more like full regalia, even the full headdress on the cover here. How much of that did he find being used? How much of it is posed?
Right. I mean, Curtis did pose his subjects, and he never denied that. I mean, very few of his pictures are taken of actual event as it happens. But sometimes it would take months and even years before they would take that actual photograph, because he wanted to know the context. He wanted to know why they wore their hair a certain way, why you'd wear a headdress a certain way, why you had the beads a certain way, why you were looking down as opposed to straight on, what it meant when Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce, the so-called Indian Napoleon, mm-hmm. told him about the braids and why it was a really big deal to wear your braids on the front of your chest as opposed on the back, as it meant you had a certain status in the society. So Curtis, to me, it's similar to you or I going to Scotland and going around and taking a photographic complete audit picture of the clans in Scotland. And we come up on the MacGregor clan and we said, you know, do you have any of the kilts that your grandfather used to wear?
Mm-hmm.
And yes. Well, would you put them on? That's what Curtis did. He saw modernity itself wiping these out, and he said, do you have a headdress that your father wore? And if someone had it, he would say, I would like you to put it on so I could see it. And they would willingly put it on. So he did pose them, but he felt like he was getting sort of the last picture before that headdress disappeared.
Some of them are just, I mean, this so-called, was it Pagan, the dandy that is
right.
This famous photograph.
I think they pronounce it Pagan. And that was one of the first of the early pictures that Curtis took in Montana when he got the big idea that, as he said, I want to make them live forever. And he realized at the same time, it's an impossibly oversized idea. I can't see it all. But yeah, the Pagan Dandy, they had kicked
unbelievable
dirt.
Photo. Young man, hair in a very dramatic fashion, sort of going off in this direction, that direction, and really dude, I mean, he called him a dandy. So his impression must have been, even in that setting, that this guy was really putting on the, I don't know, put it on the show. I mean, he's almost like Prince or something, the way he's dressed.
He is like Prince. That's very good. Well, Curtis himself was somewhat of a dandy at that point. So I said it was a projection of one dandy
yeah.
onto the other.
Yeah.
And that subject, they jousted quite a bit. That guy went back and forth with Curtis over the whole summer. And finally, in sort of a defiant thing, he said, okay, I'm going to pose for you, but I'm going to show you, you know, this is me at my most studly. And Curtis really liked that. He liked that, you know, projection of male pride and virility, which you'll see quite a bit in his pictures of young men.
Tim, we've got a listener on Facebook who says, you know, what do Native Americans think about these photographs? He says, most Indians I know speak of Curtis with derision. First of all, Indians have not vanished from our country. They're very much alive and vibrant, David says. And second, I've heard the criticism that many of the photos were so posed as to be inauthentic in many ways. What about that?
A couple of things on that. I think Curtis, as I say at the end of my book, would be incredibly pleased and happy to see that the Indians are not vanished. He thought, as did everyone at the time, 110 years ago, that they would be gone. The census of 2 years ago found 2.8 million Native Americans, full-blooded Native Americans. I think that would make Curtis very happy. Remember, he worked for Indian citizenship. Secondly, on the authenticity, no one worked harder to get it right than Curtis. And you see it in the recordings. You see it in the pictures. He always said, in order for this thing to be of lasting value, it has to be ethnologically correct. And in the whole, his pictures are ethnologically correct. He doesn't mix up Nez Perce with Apache. He doesn't mix up Hopi with Zuni. He gets them right because he spent the time with the natives themselves. The third thing. I traveled to almost every reservation that Curtis went to, and believe me, I don't know where this caller got their impression. Maybe it's urban Indians, but on the reservations themselves, Curtis is revered. You see his pictures everywhere. The Tulalip in the Pacific Northwest just opened a grand central, huge new room at their giant casino up here, and the thing is full of wall-to-wall.
Because of the dignity in these photos? Why?
Well, I'll quote another native writer, M. Scott Momaday, who won a Pulitzer Prize, and he said, this is the only photographer of the time who captured humanity, not necessarily even dignity, but humanity, that these are complete people. So I found traveling in Curtis's footsteps, going reservation to reservation, homeland to homeland, that Curtis is appreciated. They look into these eyes and they say, there's my great-grandmother. There's my great-grandfather. So I think this is a bogus claim. I really do, because my interpretation is the opposite. Also, as the tribes revived their language, especially in the Southwest, they were so appreciative of the fact that they could go to these archives of recordings and use them. And now these things are taught in the schools.
Enrico in Washington, D.C. is calling. Hi, Enrico. You're on the air with Timothy Egan.
Hi, Tom. And hi, Timothy. This is a great program. I'm a Native American. I am of the Ota Missouri tribe. I'm really appreciative of the direction the conversation has gone in the past few minutes. I have a question, a concern about how we as a people are historicized, and this idea of the vanishing Native American, and how we're often portrayed as extinct. We are a vibrant community. Like you said, there are 2.8 million of us, and we're a growing population. There are over 500 federally recognized tribes. The Native world is a robust community. And also to that end, the idea of tribal agency in how these photos, this record, is dealt with, what if any control do our people, our tribes have over these these photos, oftentimes they are capturing very sacred, very precious, very very guarded ceremonies and spiritual practices. And for them to be presented in certain contexts would be diminishing to them.
Mm-hmm.
What's the protection that these photos have in that regard?
Enrico, I'm so glad for your call. Our time is short, so forgive me. I want to have Tim respond. Tim, please.
We've gone full circle, Enrico, from making it a crime for the Native people to practice their religion to making it a crime for people to rip off Native American religions.
What do you mean?
So, I'm sorry?
What do you mean a crime to rip off?
Well, if you take certain cultural artifacts and claim them as your own, most of the tribes don't let people photograph what Curtis would have photographed. He knew in some cases he was crossing the line, especially in the cases of the Apache. But again, it's important to put this into context. The so-called Indian experts at the Smithsonian, at the time Curtis was going out to the Southwest, they had told him, he records this time again, that the Apache have no religion. And the Navajo have no religion. It's a bunch of mumbo-jumbo. They're worshiping rocks and stones and sticks and sky. So he was really fighting against this idea that he was a hollowed-out people that had no religion. Now we've come full circle, and I'm happy to see it. Curtis would have been happy to see it, where these rituals are protected. And because of Curtis, they're also preserved.
Who called him the shadow catcher?
The Hopi had called him that. So had some of the Prairie Indians. His other nickname was the man who slept on his breath, because he would go around with this little air mattress.
The modern meets the ancient. Enrico, thank you for your call. Really an interesting angle of concern right there. And Timothy Egan, thank you so much for the book, Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, the Epic Life and Immortal Photographs of Edward Curtis. Tim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
This is On Point.